Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hi, everyone. Good morning and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That's the Hall of Famer, Chris Carter. This is Nick Wright. Happy Monday. You guys have a good weekend.
I have a great weekend.
Jam-packed, fun for lots of sports you took in.
Absolutely.
Chris went to, from people from our past, and it was a great
okay. Chris went to a couple games, Big East tournament and the Knicks game. I also went to the Knicks game. Chris also bumped into some
friend of mine.
Years back.
Yes.
Jenna bumped into a guy on the street she initially tried to flee from, but then found out he was literally watching the show.
I thought the
on his phone.
The legend of Bigfoot was dead, but I met a guy. I think he's him.
All of these
these things are true.
Very interesting for our audience. Let's start. Big
Jenna
show today.
Wolf.
Jerry Jones ecstatic about what the Giants are doing. One of Big Ben's former teammates says he fumbled on purpose to stick it to a coach. Wait to hear that story. But we have
That's
to start
amazing.
This morning with the madness that is March.
Get
Selection
it,
Sunday led to Let's Talk About It Monday. Duke, UNC, Virginia, Gonzaga all getting the four number one seeds. Duke was named the number one overall seed, led by freshman phenom Zion Williamson. Duke won the ACC tournament on Saturday, and they've only lost two games all year with a healthy Zion. So as we jump ahead a few weeks, I ask you, CC, who wins the tournament, the very dominant Duke Blue Devils or the field?
I'm going with the field. I believe that an NCAA tournament has shown through the years that not only guard play, but three-point shooting and the ability to be able to upset people because of the three-point line, man, that's what happens in March Madness. So I don't believe that Duke, they shoot the ball well enough from the perimeter. They rely on getting the ball inside, playing above the rim, offensive rebound. So in the tournament, you have one bad day. With that bad shooting, it won't lead to them being victorious. So I think that this is a field, too, that is bunched together. I believe there's six to eight teams that can win it all. And that doesn't even include who might be Cinderella, either one or two. So I believe that there are a few blue bloods, that being Virginia, Duke, and North Carolina, all those getting one seeds from the ACC. That's a phenomenal thing. But do they have enough talent to be able to get it all the way to the finish line? And that's what out of that group, Nick, I like North Carolina. I believe they have more balance. I like their guard play. I like their overall shooting. They have interior post play. And I believe overall how they play with that type of pace will play well for them. Duke is a very, very talented team. They're very, very talented. But when it comes down to the tournament, a lot of times it's guards and shooting the three ball.
Well, listen, if it does come down to shooting the three ball, then Duke won't win it all. Duke is literally, of the 68 teams that made the tournament, the worst three-point shooting team in the bracket as far as
percentage. I saved that one for you. I knew you would.
But despite that, and I never take one team versus the field, I'll take Duke versus the field. They got the best player. They got the best coach. They got the best draw. And they might, as an added bonus, also have the second best player in the tournament in R.J. Barrett. The draw helps them enormously. You mentioned the Blue Bloods are the six to eight other real contenders. Michigan State is a really good two seed and a really good team. But the other teams that I would be looking out for, Kentucky, Carolina, Virginia, and a veteran-laden Tennessee team that briefly was the number one team in the nation, they are all on the opposite side of the bracket. Duke this year has lost twice with Zion Williamson playing the full game. Once to Gonzaga, and Gonzaga, a fellow one seed, by the way, where they were down huge and stormed all the way back to tie it with a minute left and then lost by two. And once to Syracuse in overtime. And the Syracuse game is noteworthy, not because I went there, but because they play that zone. And if you can't shoot the three, and you sometimes a zone team can get you. Not a lot of zone teams in Duke's region, in Duke's side of the bracket. I just think they've been the best team all year. I know they have the best player. I know they have the coach that is the most experienced, which can maybe offset the fact that Jones, Reddish, Barrett, and Zion are all freshmen. I'll take Duke. I think this is the year of Zion Williamson, the year of Duke University, and so I'll go with them.
Do you have any issue with what Nick said, the fact that they are, for all the talent they have, they are not very experienced, except for Mike Krzyzewski?
Well, it doesn't really matter that much in college basketball because there's only a few teams that have some overall experience.
Tennessee, Virginia,
People don't put Duke in the category of one and done, but over the last 5 years, they're in the one and done category. They have a bunch of one and done players, so Duke is not going to have a lot of experience. Over the last couple of years, they didn't have a lot of experience, so it's not new to the people who really follow Duke basketball, but do you want to be young and have the number one recruit, the number two recruit, and the number three recruit? And that's what they have on this show. So they do have a lot of raw talent that I believe some of that being undeveloped. And I believe that they'll be better in pro basketball than in college basketball because their inability to shoot it consistently from the three-point line or intermediate. Like, they don't have an intermediate game either. So it's just a part of where they are right now as a program. They don't want to be in that category, but Duke is one and done, and they're loving it.
I do think the winner of the East region is going to win this thing. Duke's in it, but if Duke doesn't get out of there, the only team in that region that I think has any shot of beating them is your friend's team, Tom Izzo's Michigan State team. They've got Cassius Winston.
They have all of our friends.
Okay, sure, but Chris's actual friend. They have Nick Ward back to him, some low post presence. I know Izzo was a little salty, maybe understandably, that they have the season that they did, and they end up being the lowest-ranked two seed when a lot of people thought they could maybe sneak up to the one line that was taken by either North Carolina or
Gonzaga. And they didn't
get
credit for the history that they have of being someone in March Madness, teams that even when they were underrated, man, they get on a run. So typically, the committee gives the coach and that university benefit of the doubt. They got a bad draw.
Well, and listen, this is going to consistently be on the board for a Big Ten team when Michigan State, Michigan is going down to the wire while they are putting this together. There's no way the committee could have two separate brackets, right? One with Michigan State winning the Big Ten tournament, one with Michigan winning it. So they basically have to call that game a coin flip and then make the bracket. You mentioned history. The other good storyline or big storyline of this tournament is Virginia. Virginia is a number one seed again. Virginia, of course, last year became the first one seed to ever lose to a 16. And you could throw that out if it wasn't the fact that the year before, Virginia in the second round lost by 26 points to Florida State. And the year before that, they blew a 14-point lead to Syracuse in the final minutes of the Elite Eight. And the year before that, they lost in the second round to Michigan State. And the year before that, they lost in the Sweet 16 to Michigan State. They have been the number one seed three times and only even made it to one regional final, much less a Final Four. So for Tony Bennett and Virginia, especially after what happened last year, this is an enormous tournament for them where they have to make it at least to the Elite Eight, if not to their first Final Four with him as the head coach.
All right, but the one athlete from the college ranks you'd say was the big story this weekend was Zion. Time now for Put a Grade on It, sponsored by CarMax. Zion had an incredible ACC tournament, scoring 27 points per game and being named the tournament MVP. Nick, put a grade on Zion's performance.
A triple plus, as good as you can get, 100%. In fact, so good the teacher pulled him aside and asked him if he cheated. I mean, 77% from the field, 27 points per game, tournament MVP. Duke sweeps the tournament, obviously wins the tournament when he's coming back from injury, beating three separate tournament teams, Syracuse, North Carolina, and Florida State, a one seed in the mix there. So, yeah, to me, as high of a grade as you can get.
Yeah, tournament MVP, 81 points, outstanding for Zion. First time a freshman, has been ACC Tournament Player of the Year since, I think, 75, Phil Ford, when he did it with Dean Smith and those great teams. So great weekend by Zion. And we wouldn't have seen this if he wouldn't have played, though.
It's correct. True.
Correct.
Good point. All right, let's take a break. Coming up, a stunning accusation of Big Ben fumbling on purpose to spite his coach. That's next on FS1, and you can always check us out on the Fox Sports channel on SiriusXM. We're back right after this. Welcome back to the show. We'll get to Big Ben in a second, but first, Tennessee, Mississippi State, Admiral Schofield driving down the lane destroys the defender at the rim.
Good finish here. Tennessee ran out of gas, man. Great regular season. Almost a great tournament. Got to the final, man. They ran out of gas after beating Big Blue Nation.
Florida State, Duke in transition. Zion throwing a great pass to Trey Jones for the lay-in.
Trey Jones, the one freshman of the four that's going to be back next year, and I like him as a player, or at least I think he'll be back next year.
Reddish need to come back. He ain't done nothing to me besides the buzzer beater at Florida State during the season.
Reddish has been terrible, but I don't think he's coming back. Trey Jones, I think, will. And he'll be very good next year.
Sixers, Bucks, Giannis backs down Ben Simmons, finishes with the left-handed dunk.
I don't know if people know how hard this is. Just get bodied. And Ben Simmons is not a little guy. Ben Simmons is big and strong. And for Giannis to do this, no momentum seed, just a couple dribbles, get right to his spot.
Yeah, this was embarrassing. This was embarrassing to get backed in by Ben Simmons.
Lakers and Knicks, LeBron in transition, throws a great pass through traffic to Kyle Kuzma for the finish.
Lakers played a decent game for about 44 minutes and then played about as poorly as you can in the final four to lose to the Knicks. This is the only thing Laker fans have to look for right now is LeBron and Kuzma connection.
Sticking with this game, LeBron drives to the basket, but Mario Hezonja comes up with the big block to win it for the New York Knicks.
Boom. Go ahead, C.
Big play, man. Big play. I was totally shocked, but not by this possession. What about the two or three previous possessions to that? Man, the Lakers, man, they stink. I haven't seen LeBron play with less talent than since he left the St. V, man, high school. Man, they were awful.
All right, moving on now. A stunning accusation on Twitter over the weekend regarding Ben Roethlisberger. Former Steelers running back Josh Harris said that back in 2014, Big Ben intentionally fumbled the ball. The offensive coordinator at the time, Todd Haley, had called a run play when Ben wanted to take a knee. The accusation being, Ben figured he'd prove himself right by letting go of the ball. Harris added, quote, "At that moment, I knew what kind of person Ben Roethlisberger was." CeCe, what was your reaction when you read this?
Well, first, I think that people should know that during the course of games, beginning, the middle, and the end of games, when the play comes in from the sideline, that either being a player brings it in or he gets it into his headset, there's all kind of players in the huddle don't like the play call. There's offensive linemen. If you're running the ball and you got a pass play, they're like, man, we should be running. I'm killing my guy. Wide receivers all the time. If they're not getting the ball, if they don't like it, they're always complaining about the play call. So someone complaining or not liking the decision, the coach, that's not anything new to football. Now, as far as the accusation that he deliberately fumbled the ball, I'm not going to say I don't believe it. I'm just going to say it would be hard to prove it. Now, to me, I've always questioned Ben's leadership. And the reason why is because I know other stories. I don't need this right here. Like, so it's not as if this right here was going to change my opinion on Ben Roethlisberger. To me, this is just more information that other people can look at. But I think it's very important to realize that other people in the huddle are not happy with it. Now, I haven't seen where someone sabotaged a play. I know the coaches called some routes, and I didn't want to run it, and I might have thought about it. But at the end of the day, you got a job to do. And if you don't do your job, you're going to be held accountable. So the lack of accountability that Ben had from the hierarchy would lead a player to believing that he botched the snap on purpose. So all the other things surrounding Ben, forget this. I can understand why Josh would draw that conclusion. Now, you're at the end of the game. Coach's philosophy, because Josh, he didn't have a whole bunch of carries. Todd and them might have wanted him to get him a couple carries at the end of the game to be able to milk out the clock. Now, I know from conventional wisdom, you take a knee. They don't have a timeout. You take three knees. The game's over with. No risk of injury, things like that. Because we have seen players get injured at the end of the game. So Ben saying we should take a knee, Ben's probably right. But a lot of times the coaches, they want to get some younger players a couple touches that they typically wouldn't get.
And well, in some context here. The offensive coordinator of the Times, Todd Haley. Big Ben was angry when they hired Todd Haley, was angry with Todd Haley until they ended up moving on from Todd Haley, and Haley went on with a brief stint to the Browns. Additional context. That game right there, now it's a 10-point lead. There's a minute left. The Steelers, even if they turn it over there, they almost assuredly win. But if the Bengals had won that game, the Bengals won the division that year. The Bengals finished 10-5-1. The Steelers finished 11-5. So that game at the end of the year, if I remember correctly, was, in fact, yeah, because I see the NBC sticker. It was the Sunday Night Football final game of the regular season, division on the line game. And that's the context in which this happened. Now, I can add one other piece of context, which is Josh Harris is not the only person in the Steelers organization that thought that is exactly what happened there. And it was hard to believe, and it is hard to believe because you would think, really? You're going to potentially, you mentioned injury risk, hell of a lot of injury risk, even more risk than the team losing the game. If your defense now has to go out there against a desperate offense that's running lateral plays or Hail Marys, like, you put so much in jeopardy in that spot by trying to prove a point. But if this is true, if Big Ben did that on purpose, and if the play was called what Josh Harris said it was, which is a handoff to the running back, then him sticking out to the fullback makes no sense whatsoever. Then in that context, to me, that would be as bad, if not worse, than what Antonio Brown did that we killed him for. I called that a form of, like, sports sabotage, form of, you know, where you're sports treason. You intentionally fumble because you want to show up your offensive coordinator. You thought we should have kneeled. And we don't, you know why I think we should have kneeled? Bad things can happen if you call a run play. Oh, you call a run play? I'm going to show you the worst thing that can happen. That is unforgivable. That is, I don't even know how an offensive lineman that's killing a guy in run blocking, they call a pass play, so he just olays the guy and lets the quarterback get destroyed. Like, that is unspeakably awful from a sports character perspective. And if it is true, it goes in the line of the types of things that with this quarterback wouldn't be shocking. That's the part to me that sticks out, see, is I think there's 31 quarterbacks in the league that if this story came out, it would be instantly dismissed. So some backup running back saying you did this. Yeah. With Ben, you at least have to really consider it and think about, wait, look at the video. Is that what happened there?
Well, in the video, I'm just going to tell you from a football standpoint, when he backs away, he reverses the reverse handoff to be able to hand the lead to the tailback. I guarantee you we can have footage of other quarterbacks that have fumbled by putting the ball, getting too close to the fullback and the ball being jarred out because the fullback's elbow hits the quarterback. So for me, if you didn't have that information about Ben, would you be drawing that conclusion? So for me, I don't know if he did do it. Right. I have enough other information to be able to be like in a football world that could happen.
Well, okay, so whether it happened or not, whether you believed it or not, the fact that Josh Harris came out and said something, doesn't that speak to the overall dysfunction in this locker room that was there throughout that season, the seasons prior, the fact that it gotten so bad that now players are, and you always say you keep everything in-house, but now they're divulging
secrets.
Well,
listen, we have countless examples that Big Ben is not very popular in that locker room. He's been voted team MVP once. Juju's been voted team MVP once. He's been there 2 years. AB won it 4 times. How many Steelers that have retired and gone into television have told not this story, but have let the cat out of the bag a bit in who Big Ben is? And much like Mike Tomlin said with Antonio Brown, we'll put up with it as long as he's productive. We'll put up with it as long as we have to. With Roethlisberger, it has been, listen, he's a great quarterback. He is a future Hall of Famer. He's won multiple Super Bowls. He's been to 3 of them. So what are you going to do? But the guy's not going to change. He's not going to all of a sudden in his late 30s become a better teammate.
So as long as he's there, this is who the team's going to be?
Well, that's who Big Ben's going to be. I don't know that I can assign all the drama and dysfunction to him, but as long as he's there, that's who he's going to be.
Right, and Josh Harris has nothing to do with the culture that they have now. I was wondering why he said something at this point. And to me, I don't want to be a person that's piling on, and just because I see some smoke coming from the wood pile to believe that the house is on fire. All right? I have my own information about Ben Roethlisberger. It has nothing to do with this fumble. As far as this, does this equate to what Antonio Brown did? I would say absolutely not. It doesn't equate to that because, for number one, we can't prove it. We can prove what Antonio did. Like we can prove that. And this game, for the most part, they're in the red zone going the other way. The other team's got to go 75 yards, and they got to be able to score twice. So I believe that the comparison between the two is totally different, and this part right here is not proven.
Well, and I, to be clear, if I wasn't before, I said that if this is true, it's the same thing as what Antonio Brown did to me. Now, I understand your point that even if it's true, it didn't put their team in
no,
as bad.
No, they needed to win the game. Antonio, they needed to win the game, Pittsburgh. Antonio decided not to come and play.
Mm-hmm.
So the Pittsburgh trying to clinch the division in the last minute, 90 seconds of the game, and if Ben decided to do that, if it being true, it's not the same as a guy not coming to the game because the team didn't have a chance. The team didn't – I'm not even going to give you my services for the game. Ben had played three and a half quarters.
Right. He played almost the entire game.
I mean, so it's just not the same. It's not the same. I know Ben Roethlisberger because Antonio's gone. El Bell is gone. Ben Roethlisberger is going to get a lot of criticism based on what the general manager said. But I don't need this information to change my opinion of what I thought in Ben and his lack of leadership, the lack of consistency that they have there in Pittsburgh.
All right. We're going to take a break there. Coming up. Why is a Hall of Famer taking shots at LeBron James? That's next on.
That's what I was doing yesterday at the game.
Division champion Lamont Peterson takes on former 140-pound champion Sergey Lipinets in a headlining 12-round welterweight showdown. It is Sunday, 6 Eastern, only on FS1 and the Fox Sports app. Time now for Say What? Russell Westbrook will serve a one-game suspension tonight after receiving his 16th technical foul of the season on Saturday. And Russ channeled his inner Bill Belichick when was asked about how he felt about the call. Say what?
Russell, you got your 16th technical. Do you have any hopes of getting that one rescinded so you can play Monday night?
Next question. Russ, were you aware that you were at 15? Next question. Are you disappointed with yourself for picking up your 16? Next question.
Well, definitely. In the beginning, he's not going to say anything about the call because it'll cost him $25,000 to $50,000. But Russell also, listen, man, he had a terrible game. They got crushed.
Yeah.
He's now going to be suspended.
Clay locked him up, man.
I mean, it was his worst game, arguably, of the year.
Mm-hmm.
He's 2 of 16, I think 7 points in that game. And he's not, listen, Russ don't love the media. He's going to be terse. And a little edgy towards the
Russ should be bigger than this. You shouldn't be leading the NBA. Now you get suspended. Now you can't be available for your team. It don't matter. It don't make sense for him to act that way. You've been in the league too long. Now you've had an incident with the fan, with the kid. Now, Russ, it's time to slow things down. You are part of the face of the NBA. All right? Enough is enough.
Well, that point on this 16 techs, when Oklahoma City is desperately trying to get back to the three line to avoid that 4-5 matchup, yeah. Avoid Golden State in the first round, that matters
uncalled for.
A lot more than the no comment or next question in the postgame press conference.
My takeaway was the amount of ice that was
in that
cup.
I knew that was coming.
I mean, put more liquid
Jen.
In it so there's not so much shaking. Time for stories to start your morning. Sponsored by Gillette Clear Gel. The NCAA bracket was released yesterday. Duke, UVA, UNC and Gonzaga are your one seed. Snick, what's the biggest storyline of the tournament in your opinion?
To me, there's one on each side of the bracket. On the left side, it's Duke and the year of Zion Williamson. Can he trump the year Carmelo Anthony had, which is considered probably the best freshman year in modern NCAA history? And on the right side of the bracket, Virginia, can they finally even come close to living up to their seed? To me, those are the two dueling storylines of this tournament.
To me, the question is, who's going to be Cinderella? We know she always shows up, and it doesn't come in any form or fashion. We don't know East, Mideast, West. We don't know where she's coming from, but she will show up to the dance, and people will be cheering. That's why we watch March Madness. We're going to see Zion play in the pros.
Real quick, last year, C was made to pick a Cinderella, didn't want to do it, but grudgingly picked Loyola Chicago, and then they ended up making that whole
being on TV, year. I'm trying to teach you this is about being right. You just think it's your last name.
Okay.
The NBA now. Sixers beat the Bucks 130 to 125 yesterday. Giannis had 52 in the loss, with Joel Embiid leading the way for the Sixers with 40. Nick, which one of these teams is more likely to come out of the East?
Man, Milwaukee's been the best team all year, but underrated undercover. They suffered a major injury this week in Malcolm Brogdon being out, I think, probably for the rest of the year. I know they're saying 6 to 8 weeks. That means more minutes for George Hill. That means more pressure on Giannis when we know the defenses in a series are going to play off him. Milwaukee right now still with an asterisk, but Philly is coming and Toronto's been there all year long.
Yeah, we can't determine who's going to be the best in the East. When you lose a starter, and we've seen this with playoff runs, man, you get injuries down the stretch, and there it is on the board that he could miss all of the postseason. So right now, there is no best team in the East.
All right, moving on to the New York Giants. They reportedly are not interested in scouting quarterback Dwayne Haskins. Seems like they will continue to ride with 38-year-old Eli Manning, who will turn 39 in January, and then 40 the January after that, so on and so forth. CC, good move by the Giants?
I mean, I don't believe it's true. I don't believe this is true. I believe the Giants do have an interest in him. I know they sat down with him. He was very pleased with the interview that they did at the Combine. He felt like the time was very, very special. He let them know he was born in New Jersey, grew up a Giants fan, and would love playing. So we're in the lying season in the NFL, and I believe this to be one of many lies to be told.
It would be a total dereliction of duty if they don't do full due diligence on Dwayne Haskins. Now, we're going to find out the 25-player visits they have. That's official. That's on a list. Like, you have to disclose that. So if they don't invite Dwayne Haskins for one of those 25 visits, then there will be more than smoke to this fire. There'll be fire to this smoke.
Be careful if they don't bring him for the visit, because they could steal. Not worry about it. Be concerned about a team jumping in front of them. They could not invite them and still draft
as like.
I would just say be leery of this.
It's like the double dog under lie. Finally, the Cowboys have gotten their fair share of facing Odell Beckham Jr. over the last 5 years. It's exactly like that. But the trade from the NFC East to the AFC North has Jerry Jones very happy. Jerry was at the Spence Garcia fight in Dallas. Take a listen.
I'm a Browns fan because I'm from Cleveland. We took a fantastic wide receiver out of your division, Odell Beckham Jr. How you feel about that?
Thank you. That's probably put
well,
it
hey,
on.
Hey, now you got to watch your back.
Well,
we're coming for you.
Clearly the best news he's heard in a long time. CeCe, how much tougher will it be for the Giants without Odell in their lineup?
Well, this is the thing. The Giants, and I know Gettleman and their staff, they're what they're thinking is, they had some success as they finished the season. Not the kind of season they wanted, but the last month of football, the last several weeks where Odell was out of the lineup, they played some good football for them. So they want to be a running team. They want to be physical. But it's about winning football games. And you can win without a dynamic receiver, but I think it's more of a shock to the fans there. I mean, he is iconic in this area, and Giants fans never thought that he would have left, especially left that quick. But you can still win football games. You can still come up with a good game plan. The thing about what we don't see is we don't like the quarterback. They don't have a bunch of explosive players outside of Barkley. They can't rush the passer. Their defense is not good. So how are they going to play football?
That's everything.
So for me, I just do believe now there is life after Odell Beckham. I just haven't seen the plan yet. So you can win football games without a star wide receiver. I just haven't seen the plan formulated with the Giants.
Well, and the Giants had a hard enough time winning football games with a star wide receiver. Listen, people have been making the point. The Giants, they had a losing record with Odell. They're right. In games Odell played in his career, they won about 43% of them. That's bad. In games he didn't play, they won around 25% of them. That's awful. The Giants' offense in games Odell played since he came in the league scored around 23 points per game. That's okay. It's not elite. In games he hasn't played, they've scored around 17 points per game. That's awful. So, like, they haven't been great with Odell, but they've been horrible without him. What I'm curious for you, see, is you mentioned Giants fans are upset, you know, disappointed about this. What about Saquon? Like, what type of fronts and coverages is Saquon going to be dealing with next year with Odell not out there? Like, how much easier? Because Saquon was excellent last year. I also thought Odell helped him tremendously as far as dictating double teams and dictating coverages. How much harder did Saquon's job get when instead of having Odell Beckham, they got a couple draft picks?
I don't think his job got any harder from a football standpoint. He's a phenomenal player. And if you look at a lot of his runs, the big runs, he did it on his own. It's just people on the field. Now, from a coverage standpoint, we can't think back to the 60s. They're not going to put 9 people in the box, all right? So let's not start saying this, all right? Most teams don't even put 8 people in the box, but they will have a heavy contention. The same thing we said about Ezekiel Elliott. When he was in Dallas, the same thing.
They got a better
offensive line. So it's the same situation that other running backs are going to face. I think his hardest problem is going to be dealing with the media because he's the only star. So he's got to do all the interviews. He's got to do all the sound bites. He's got to ask, man, well, what do you think about the Giants' future? What do you think about Eli? He's going to have to lie. So for me, the football part, he's a natural runner, can catch the ball out of the backfield, is a star already. But it's off the field. Answering all those questions, all those leadership things, that right there becomes more difficult immediately.
But to Jerry's point, and we said it the day after the trade, the happiest people were Browns fans, the people of the Browns organization. The next three happiest were Cowboys fans, Eagles fans, and Washington fans because there's two games a year they don't have to deal with Odell Beckham.
All right, let's move on to the NBA now. Lakers lost a brutal game to the Knicks yesterday. With a chance to win, LeBron's shot was blocked at the buzzer by Mario Hezonja that capped a 4-of-15 quarter for LeBron, the worst of his career. Earlier in the game, Knicks analyst and Hall of Famer Walt Frazier cast some interesting criticism on LeBron. Take a listen.
This type of behavior is not... When you're the face of the NBA, I think you should be more a part of your team, folks. No matter what is going in the public, you've got to be a part of the team. Maybe in the locker room, you're not, but you have to exude that type of togetherness in public, folks. And right now, we see he doesn't really care. So that's why this man is rumored to, this is his last season as the Laker coach.
A lot going on with this Lakers team. Nick, what was your reaction to what Clyde had to say?
I have so much respect for Clyde Frazier. He's one of the best two-way guards in NBA history. He's a champion. I love him as a commentator. But that was ridiculous. I don't think Clyde knew that the guy in a suit he was talking to from where he was sitting is one of his teammates. He's talking to Tyson Chandler. He went back at LeBron later in the game for sitting in his customary seat at the end of the bench saying he's making all the guys look. He's making all the guys stand up and move down. Lonzo was sitting there. Lonzo stood up. LeBron and he did a whole little handshake and were joking together when he sat down. There are so many fair criticisms of LeBron this season and last night. You said it. In the fourth quarter, he was as bad as he's been in any quarter all year, especially at the end. Well, not just 4-15. Last 90 seconds, he had a missed three when Kuzma was open. He didn't have to take it. He had a missed layup where he said he got fouled. He missed a jumper, and then Hezonja locked him. Like, that's 0-for-4 in the last 90 seconds of the game. But the idea that because LeBron's talking to a teammate, to Tyson Chandler, he's disconnected from the whole organization.
Or was it that he was so far down while the guys were, I mean, he was 3 or 4 seats removed from everyone.
Right, but as soon as the timeout's over, there's someone sitting right next to him.
Right, how about this? How about he don't know what he's talking about? How about that? All right, now, you might respect him as a two guard, as a commentator. Man, the way he dresses and everything in his commentary, to me, is very, very questionable. This is a guy that, to me, his comments were just out of touch. All right, LeBron is here. He's making his one visit to New York City. And me, as one of the legends of the game, you know something? I'm going to watch this game. And as soon as I get an opportunity, because I was at the game, I commented to Dusty. LeBron was at the end of the bench, sitting there. All right, we were talking about, and we knew that Tyson was right there behind him. That's where LeBron typically always seats. And what Clyde missed out on was Lance Stephenson and Lonzo, they were working out with the team. Either they were doing some type of rehab in the back. They were getting some type of workout in. They came out to the game late. Those seats were saved for them. So LeBron was in his seat. He knew they were going to be coming out of the locker room. And if he would have talked about that, he would have known, and it would have really created a picture. And I know he's not watching the Lakers. I watch the Lakers. I watched LeBron James play every high school. All right. Now, that was the least talented team I've seen since he played at St. V on ESPN. But that's not the commentary. But if you want to say something bad, if you want to say negative things, yeah, you could be like, man, LeBron is bored. Yeah, LeBron is a little bit away from his teammates. But the truth of the matter is, if you watch the Lakers, this is no different. If you watch the LeBron with the Heat, this is no different. With the Cavs, this is no different. So for me, Clyde missed on this one, and I was at the game, and I was watching.
This is the same thing. A couple weeks ago, LeBron, in three consecutive games at the end of a quarter, or in two consecutive games at the end of a quarter, trying to get a 2-for-1, had the ball rolled all the way up the court and then took a 3. And the first one was in a Saturday night game. I guess no one was watching because then it happened in a nationally televised game on Monday and the announcers panicked about it. I've never seen that in my life. And then it happened a couple games later and he fumbled the ball out of bounds. And it was a big meme and it was a thing that people were talking about, like, oh, this is how little LeBron cares at this point in the season. Like, there is an element of this is, especially when you have the stature Clyde has.
Right.
Because I'm not the only person that holds him in that regard. And I do think he's a legend. I know he's a legend on the court. And people can, you know, feel different ways about his commentary. I like listening to him. I think
and his dress.
Okay, well, again, that's a separate discussion. I think the Knicks have a great broadcast, and I enjoy listening to it. But that's, this is the year, and I apologize for using this word, but there's not a word in our language for it, of schadenfreude. For people that don't like LeBron James, taking joy in his failure. And they are going to this year find anyone that has been waiting for or has an axe to grind.
Sure.
This is the year to do it. And he always, to C's point, sits in that spot. And he killed him for not being a part of the team when he was walking there the second time. And we showed it. While he's mid killing him for not being a part of a team, he and Lonzo have a little interaction. I really believe he didn't think, he thought Tyson Chandler was a fan. That he didn't realize that that was one of his teammates. Or else, how do you make the statement he's disconnected from his team while he's talking to one of the veterans on the team?
And since all the other guys have gotten hurt, LeBron knows he's the face of the NBA. He don't need Clyde to be able to tell him that. That's the only reason why he's out there playing. That's the only reason why. Look at the last two games that they played. I mean, this is not a fun time in LeBron's career. But you can see with him out there, he is putting forth the effort. He is not mailing it in. I was saying they should put him on the rack. But LeBron's pride and knowing that he's the face of the NBA, that's what's got him out there. LeBron knew it was a sellout crowd yesterday. That's why he put the type of effort into it. But he went down like Jordan would go down, at least shooting it. Typically, you don't see LeBron take 15 shots in the fourth. Every game he's taking 15 shots in, I can tell you he cared about. Now, there was a game, there was a stint in Dallas where he went to the corner, and that was the time people said, wow, he looked like he didn't care. This right here, I just believe he missed on it. I believe he didn't see what was really going on as far as him talking to his teammate. And this is the only time LeBron's going to be in the Garden, and he wanted to say something negative about LeBron, and he said it.
LeBron isn't a Kevin Durant or Russ Westbrook. He's not a polarizing figure of sorts. He's relatively beloved. Why has he become such an easy target?
I disagree with the premise. LeBron's not mean with the media. LeBron is very strategic. LeBron hasn't had the spouts with the media that Kyrie or KD or Russ has had. But LeBron's been the most polarizing guy in the league for a very long time.
That's
LeBron was the original black hat as far as because of changing teams. And he wore it for a year and hated it. But this, to me, is a lesson. And one of the reasons why I think guys like Russ and others are so apprehensive of the media and how quickly folks will turn on you. 11 months ago, the story on LeBron as a teammate was, look at him carrying this Cavs team. And the year before that, it was LeBron is such a loyal teammate, he's making Dan Gilbert overpay for his friends, getting Tristan paid, getting JR paid. Like, in Miami, it was guys either coming out of retirement or taking less to come play with him. And now, this has been a season from hell. And that was a quarter from hell for LeBron in the fourth quarter at the Garden last night. And now it's just, as I've said before, the Jackals are out. And if you had something you wanted to say negative about LeBron, you didn't have a chance last year.
Yeah, this criticism of LeBron from Clyde Drexler, he might be an icon as far as playing the game, and he is a Hall of Famer. But he ain't no Hall of Fame broadcaster.
Right.
And he definitely ain't no Hall of Fame dresser. It will not change how people felt. If you felt about LeBron before the game, you felt the same way afterward. He did not illuminate or do anything. He didn't give us any insight, and he actually missed. LeBron was there talking to one of the guys he can really relate to within the organization in Tyson Chandler.
All right, we're going to take a break there. Coming up, can Zion lead Duke to an NCAA title? That is next on First Things
First. Yeah, change the outfits too. They whack.
Back here, First Things First, that guy, Super Bowl champ Chris Kenny, joins us.
In the building.
Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Jenna.
How are
you
doing? Nice to see you. I am
in
great.
In the building.
In the
what?
Building.
No, I like it.
I got to have some
presence,
Nick.
I mean, you popped your suit.
Yeah.
Looked right in the camera, Chris Kenny. In the building.
I don't know why.
Y'all did everything but the finger guns, man.
This
liked
dude
it.
Don't know nothing about swag, man.
Well, I'm just saying, you look good, you play good, don't you see?
No, happening? Uh-huh.
No, it's fine.
Let's
go
start
ahead.
Start talking sports. Odell Beckham was traded to the Browns last week, pairing him with hotshot quarterback Baker Mayfield, former LSU teammate Jarvis Landry. And that's not including a stacked backfield led by Nick Chubb. To say Baker is excited about his team's potential on offense would be like saying Nick thinks highly of LeBron. Take a listen.
An exciting time in Cleveland. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the fans there, after having a decent year, nothing that we were too happy about, were unbelievably satisfied. But now I can't even imagine. I haven't been back yet. So it's going to be really exciting when we go back.
What about throwing to OBJ?
It'll be exciting. You know, you got two LSU Tigers throwing two, and then obviously we have a lot more talent too. So it's going to be a thing where you pick your poison.
All right, Chris, what does this mean for defenses out there to have to stop these guys? How difficult will it be to defend the Browns' offense with Odell as part of it?
Well, I think potentially it could be one of the best offenses in the National Football League. If you're asking me to qualify that, I think they can be a top five scoring offense. If you look at the Indianapolis Colts, they were fifth in points scored at 27 a game. In the second half of the season last year, where the Browns were 5-3, that offense was scoring 24 points a game. It was up from 21 points a game in the first half of the season. So I think that there's something to be said for what Freddie Kitchens has done with Baker Mayfield, the chemistry that they've established, the rapport, just the familiarity with the play calling, and now introducing a weapon like Odell Beckham Jr. I think it gives Freddie Kitchens a lot of versatility from an X's and O's standpoint. And when you have that type of situation, that type of skill position group on a team, I mean, it's a problem for defenses.
And the problem exists because of this. Not just because of the talent, not because just the names, but because Freddie Kitchens did show us, as an unproven football coach and now being the head football coach, that he's going to have balance and he's going to protect his quarterback with some type of running game. That was one of the biggest differences between what they went with from Hugh to Kitchens, was they started running the football. And when you have the running the football, their offensive line, which was young, they start developing some confidence. And then when you can run it, what you do is play action. And Odell Beckham has not been able to utilize that, because only for a half a year did he have a real legitimate running threat with the New York Football Giants. Eli, inconsistent as a thrower since Odell has been there. We've known that. Odell is really special at the underneath, especially the really quick routes and everything, as far as get the ball in his hand and have him do something. So you add all these different variables as far as how I can attack the defense. Not only do I have not Nick Chubb in his rookie season, I got him in year number two, where he knows he's a legitimate running back. You got an offensive line I'm not trying to build confidence in. They already have an extreme amount of confidence. And then when teams start to get tired, I'm going to get Kareem Hunt coming off that 8-game suspension. So my ability to be able to, I can go short in Juku. I can go to Jarvis Landry because they can move the sticks for me. I can cut your head off with Odell with a deep threat. We know he can run all the short intermediate stuff. Mm-hmm. I just believe on certain days, if you take away something, well, they can do this, and they can threaten all parts of the field because their tight end is underrated. Jarvis Landry, he's a catch machine underneath. And then Odell, he's one of the most frightful, most terrifying and deep weapons that we have. And I believe that that will be illuminated to the best we've seen with Freddie Kitchens calling the plays and the play action, because they can legitimately run the ball.
And Canty, your point about that they were already up to 24 points per game, that was with their second and third receivers being rookie Antonio Callaway and Rashad Higgins. Now everybody drops down a tier. Jarvis Landry, who almost got 1,000 yards last year, is going to be seeing so much more favorable coverage than he saw last season. And it's with Baker having last year under his belt, and Baker was two guys last season, pre and post Hugh. We can show it to you. Pre Hugh, the people were excited about Baker, but the numbers weren't great. It was, he had moments. Post Hugh, that's the right hand column. The moments were games where he was one of the five highest rated passers in football the second half of the season. His yards per attempt was top two in the NFL the second half of the season. So even if they hadn't added Odell, just by adding Kareem Hunt for the second half of the year and the adjustment or maturation of the young guys Chris talking about, I would have expected the Browns offense to take a big jump this year because of Baker and the young players. You add arguably the most talented receiver in football to that, and I totally agree with you. Top five offense should be their statistical goal for that side of the football.
Yeah, it should be a goal, but I think a lot of times when you look at around the league, when you look at the top offenses and that being you know, Kansas City. We know the Rams. We can throw in a couple more with the Saints. But when you start looking at the top five offenses this season, I want you to look at who's going to have the best defense. And I believe the Cleveland Browns are going to be in that conversation. Mm-hmm. So not only do they have that collection, and I know the question is offensively how you defend them, but they got a defense and get after the passer. They got a defense create some turnovers. So they're an offense that it's better than the Rams' offense. It's better than Kansas City's offense because how it's going to be supported, Canty, by that defense.
Canty, you have all this talent on your team. Are you at any disadvantage because you have such a young head coach who doesn't have the experience to deal with all that talent and make sure you get the best of it on the field?
No, there's going to be a little bit of learning curve for Freddie Kitchens because this is his first time being in this role full time. So, you know, every coach goes through that process of being able to learn and just figuring out what his style is going to be. But in terms of what we saw in the second half of this season for the Cleveland Browns last year, I think this is a confident group. And I'm not just talking about the guys in the locker room, but I'm talking about the coaching staff and the people in the front office. And they have reason to be confident. They were 5-3 in the second half, and the three losses that they have were to all playoff teams. So, I mean, I think that's a big thing. And, CeCe, you hit the nail on the head when talking about how good this offense can be. Their defense is going to create field position and extra possessions for them. The only part of that group I'm really worried about is the back end because they got Demaryius Randle at safety. They got Denzel Ward at corner and then a bunch of other guys.
Right.
So they're going to have to figure out that part. Who are you going to be your second and third corners? But in terms of the other levels of that defense, there's a lot to feel good about. But looking at the Cleveland Browns as a whole, I think they have the ability offensively to be able to match up with anybody in terms of personnel groupings. They can go 11 personnel, which is one tight end, one running back, and three wide receivers. They can go 12 personnel with two tight ends because they added Demetrius Harris this offseason, and their 12 personnel can play like 11 because they can detach one of those tight ends.
Yes.
From a defensive perspective, that puts a lot of pressure on those guys because you don't know whether you want to match up in base defense, nickel defense, dime defense, just depending on the personnel grouping. So I think that gives Freddie Kitchens the opportunity to create a lot of advantages for a lot of talented players in that skill position
and
core.
When you're going unit by unit, offense and defense, and we have to drill down to, I don't like half of their secondary, you know what that reminds me of? When you were talking about the Rams before last year. It's like, we like this, we like this, we like that. Their linebacking core, I think, has some question marks, right? Like, that when you have that complete of a team, I'm agreeing with you, Candy. Like, when you are, to me, we know they have pass rushers. Chris talked about their offensive line. They have, as far as skill position unit guys, pass catchers, running back, quarterback, I think they will be top five in the NFL. That if you have to go to that, I don't want to say it's that small of a detail, but that drill it down that far, that's a team that should be positioned to win their division. That should be a favorite to make the playoffs, as Vegas has the Browns, and I think as we have the Browns.
Well, and here's the one thing I'll say about that Browns offense, and we continue to talk about it, all the different pieces that they have. They have the ability to morph into whoever they need to be in order to take advantage of the weaknesses, the deficiencies of the opposing defensive group. If you look at some of the best offenses, especially when it comes winning time in the postseason, they all have the ability to do that. CeCe, we were talking about the New England Patriots in the postseason, right, where everybody's going 11 personnel. They decided they were going to play big boy football and jump into 21 personnel, two running backs, and one tight end. And look at how much success they had against the Chargers and the Kansas City Chiefs. If you're going to be successful, if you're going to have an explosive offense, you have to be able to change week to week based on the matchups that you have.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned New England. You also mentioned the tough period in the season when you won your Super Bowl ring, because what is Freddie Kitchens? You had a good question. It's Freddie Kitchens' youth. People, we just glossed over it. It's a real thing. NFL football is difficult. We got a bunch of guys out there with a bunch of experience, and they struggle. For us to think he's not going to struggle, we would be missing what we've watched in pro football. So when they hit that month, like New England hit last year when everyone was giving up on them, they had Belichick to be able to stabilize the ship. So you got a lot of young, volatile players. It becomes important that in that rut, what does Freddie Kitchens do? Because that's what the players are going to respect. He's going against Harbaugh. He's going against Tomlin. Like, he's at a serious disadvantage from an experience standpoint. So that's something that we just can't give him credit for. Yes, they're talented. Yes, they're very, very young. And the coach is young. And we need to see where that's going, because that will be one of the storylines for 2019 season.
All right, Chris, we'll see you a little bit later on in the show. Take a break coming up. Talk some Sixers. Can Joel Embiid lead his team on a finals run? Next on First Things First. Sunday. the Monster Energy Series moves over to FS1. Check out all the NASCAR action from Martinsville starting at 2 Eastern only on FS1 and the Fox Sports app. Welcome back to First Things First. What's happening here?
What up, Action Jack?
Look who's glad here. NBA glad champ Steven back. Jackson.
You know why he's welcome back. One of, if not our favorite guest.
Oh,
he hadn't been, Steven, you haven't been here in a while.
Yes.
So he came with gifts.
Yes.
Brought me some shades, getting ready for the springtime in New York. I appreciate that, Steven. Thank you.
That's Jay-Z, best right-hand man, Vegas Jones. That's his glasses, called Clash. Nice glass, rose gold.
And now they're Nick Wright's glasses, Nick Wright so I glass. Appreciate that. Jenna?
That chain you're wearing.
That's his. He ain't giving that away.
You're not giving that
that's
away?
Me, not
that turtleneck you're wearing looks great on me.
Thank you.
Steven, the NBA gifted us a Sunday afternoon of great basketball. Sixers and Bucks. We start in the fourth quarter. Giannis all over Ben Simmons, two of his 52, and some not nice words for Ben Simmons afterwards. So next possession, Simmons gets the putback slam over Giannis, and he stares him down. Less than a minute to go, there's Joel Embiid. Three of his 40 to ice the game. Sixers win 130 to 125. Steven, I'll start with you. Which team has a better chance to come out of the East at this point, Sixers or Bucks?
Well, I have Sixers. If Jimmy Butler can play, be aggressive like that, and Joel Embiid can be dominant on both ends, I think they showed their hand too early just in case they have to play Milwaukee. They shouldn't have put Embiid on Greek Freak, and it worked. For the first half, it worked. You have a big body that can move with him, that can contest his shots. I love it. But Greek Freak is definitely my MVP. He's definitely my MVP. I feel like Philadelphia has a great team. They have a better team. They can go farther. I didn't like the way Greek Freak backed down Ben Simmons as we're looking at the camera now. You got to fight. You got to fight more. You're 7, you're 6'9", 6'10", so you got to fight a guy. You can't just let a guy do you like that. But that shows why Greek Freak is the MVP. But better team, I got Philly.
Well, listen, you mentioned you didn't think they should show their hand. This is a really important game for them.
Mm-hmm.
Philly, Indiana, Boston, much like what's going on out west, all those teams trying to avoid the 4-5.
Right.
You really want that 3-line, your first-round matchup so much easier, mm-hmm. and you avoid Milwaukee in the second round. So I understand why your point that you don't want to be in a position where you want to hold as much back as you can for the postseason, but this was a critical game. Philly was my preseason pick. Now, Milwaukee has been the best team in basketball throughout the year, but the Malcolm Brogdon injury terrifies me.
Mm-hmm.
He's been excellent. He was a rookie of the year. He also is neck and neck with Mark Price and Steph Curry for best free throw shooter in NBA history. So when Giannis, your best player, he's not the most reliable free throw shooter, right?
Right.
So you, at the end of the games, being able to go to Malcolm Brogdon, which you know.
Accumulate those fouls to Giannis.
That was one of the big advantages teams were going to have over Philly, is the inability of Ben Simmons to shoot free throws late in games, but all their other starters can. So to me, it's a three-headed coin out east. I don't want to leave out Toronto, but Philly and Milwaukee. I can't dismiss Philly. I know Chris has real concerns about their offense late in games because of Ben Simmons. I love Philly's starting lineup. I love what Joel Embiid's done all year long. And they, of every team in basketball, are the most improved from the start of the season to right now. They got Jimmy Butler and Tobias Harris throughout the year. And what they showed yesterday was, man, they can go toe-to-toe with Milwaukee when on Milwaukee's court, when Giannis drops a 50-piece and beat you, that game from Philadelphia offensively, that game can beat anybody.
Yeah, I think that we have to watch Milwaukee and be careful because they've been the most consistent, and they have been the best team in the East. But in these last 10 or 12 games, they're going to evolve into a different team. So right now it's on the board that those three are four teams because I believe Boston will be in the mix because the playoffs – it's about matchups.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the wrong matchup. And now with Milwaukee being a – now, they had tremendous depth, tremendous shooting. How they shot the three and scored the basketball in the paint, that combination had been a tremendous one for them throughout the season. So now we have to watch them because they're going to evolve into a different team. We don't know who they're going to be. I believe Philly is going to have some problems coming down the stretch for a number of different reasons. They're not a good road team, even though they did win that game. So Boston and Toronto, I believe, because of their strong point guard play, will give both of these teams problems. So these last 10 games, they become very important, where typically, if you played as good as Milwaukee, you would be able to rest, be fresh. But no, Philly can't rest. Boston can't rest. Toronto can't rest. And Milwaukee, because they're trying to evolve and figure out who's going to fill that void, that role, that, because Brogdon it will be missing and could be missing for the rest of the season. To me, it makes these last 10 games more intriguing.
It makes them more important, but at the end of the day, when you look at the playoffs, anybody can get beat in a seven-game series. I was a part of a team that beat a one seed, and we was the eight seed. So anybody can win in a seven-game series, but at the same time, I like Philadelphia because the game slows down in the playoffs. You need more than one guy you can throw the ball to when the game slows down in the playoffs. Milwaukee only have Greek Freak. I don't see anybody else they can go to in the fourth quarter to score four or five buckets in a row. Philadelphia, you have Big Fella. You have Jimmy Butler. You have Tobias Harris. You have a couple guys you can go to that can get you buckets. I think when the playoffs start, you got to have multiple guys that can get you buckets.
Chris's issue, though, with Philadelphia, correct me if I'm wrong, is Ben Simmons and his inability to rely on him as a shooter other than going right in the paint there. Do you have issues with Ben Simmons and how much you can rely on him moving forward?
I have a problem with every player that can't shoot a free throw or can't shoot a jumper that's in the NBA. Not just him. Everybody, LeBron, that can't make free throws, all the stars that can't make free throws, I have a problem with all of them. This is a part of the game, the easiest part of the game. And not having a jump shot, it definitely takes away from how good Philly can be. One thing about it, at the end of the game, he's a great passer, so you got him taking it out. You don't have to worry about him shooting the free throws.
I question, too, his overall, even though I know he's a ball handler, he's convinced them to turn him into a point guard. And my biggest problem is he doesn't run the offense effectively, especially when you slow down. Mm-hmm. You talked about the playoffs is more half court, where they don't really have an effective way to start their offense. You could see late in games, he gives up his dribble as if he was in a middle schooler. Mm-hmm. Like a normal point guard knows, even if I don't have what I want, I'm going to keep dribbling to keep my dribble alive. Mm-hmm. And there's some small things as far as getting a hot shooter the ball in the right spot, running the offense at the end of games when it becomes very important with timeouts and dead ball situations. Those are the things that that's the main worry. His shooting is secondary. I'm going to leave that alone. It's obvious he can't shoot. But for me, because he's not a pure point guard, and they play him as a pure point guard, I believe it's hard to run the offense.
Speaking of the point guard on Milwaukee, one of the other reasons Brogdon's so concerning, him being out, is George Hill's now going to get those minutes. Mm-hmm. And I've seen George Hill in the playoffs throughout his career, not just last year with Cleveland. That's always been the problem for him is his playoff numbers compared to his regular season numbers, they drop off a cliff, which is why all four of these teams now got a flaw. Like Milwaukee was top four offense, top four defense. You say the MVP, he's going to finish first or second in the MVP. The coach has been excellent. But now they're the team dealing with an injury. Philly, I look at the flaw more of lack of depth than Ben Simmons, but I know you got concerns about both of those. For Boston, it's been, okay, you've been inconsistent all year long. And Toronto, nobody's seen Nick Nurse coach in the playoffs. Nobody has seen this team together in the postseason. So all those teams have one yeah, but about them. Philly has the most talent. And if your biggest weakness in your starting lineup is Ben Simmons, then you have an unbelievable starting lineup. So when Philly plays their best, I think Philly's best game beats all these teams. Can they put their best basketball together for 2 weeks in a series against any of these three?
Point guards matter, though. Rondo, Andre Miller, those type of guys make their name in the playoffs. Point guards matter.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.